President Trump declared Sunday night that he was not a racist and insisted that the derogatory comment attributed to him during an Oval Office meeting on immigration last week did not occur. Last week, he used the phrase "s-hole countries" to refer to Haiti and some African and Latin American countries. He also denied that the remark made in the context of debate over U.S. immigration policy showed him to be a racist. We're talking over the latest developments in politics on The Morning Show. Good to have you along. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa and a faculty advisor to the University of Iowa College Republicans. He's also the author of a book titled Iowa Votes, Registration Demographics 1982 to 2016. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, let's first off start talking about immigration. Negotiations collapsed last week after the White House and GOP lawmakers rejected a deal from a bipartisan group of senators. And then on Thursday of last week, President Trump used vulgar language while discussing the fate of immigrants from Haiti, El Salvador, and African nations. And that's when the conversation went that direction. And then the tweet, I guess about 17 or so hours ago, the president said Senator Dick Durbin just blew DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. So where do we stand right now, Tim, on this issue?
Well, it doesn't look like we're going to be making progress anytime soon. We had sort of heard that there was a desire on the part of a variety of people, Democrats and Republicans, to get it done by this Friday in conjunction with the deal to pass a budget or get something done so that the government doesn't close down, probably another continuing resolution of some sort. But that's kind of a false deadline in terms of the DACA stuff. But it looks like that's fallen through. And so whatever, if anything happens with dealing particularly with the so-called Dreamers, but if immigration more broadly, it's going to take a lot longer because, again, as you were just saying in your lead in there, it looks like it's kind of fallen through for a variety of reasons.
So where do we stand then on negotiations? Are lawmakers dug in on immigration? It looks like there was some bipartisan reaching across the aisle last week, but when they went to the president said, go back and do more work.
Yeah, the president had said that he wants basically four things, that obviously he wanted to deal with the what are called the Dreamers, the people that had come here as children by brought here by their parents illegally, but also to deal with border security or the wall, whichever term you want to use for that. But the president also wanted something to deal with chain migration, which means that if one person is a citizen, either born here or otherwise, and brings in other people that would not normally come in, at least through that process, and then basically dealing with the visa lottery system too, so that it was based on merit rather than just a pure lottery kind of a thing. And apparently the bipartisan deal that was offered didn't handle especially the chain migration and the visa lottery as well as he wanted, and that's what caused the problem, and that's apparently what caused the president to use the vulgar language in the context of the immigration debate in that meeting, and then the thing kind of blew up. A part of it was probably, again, the language that the president used, and just assuming that he even used that language, he says he didn't, and some senators, Republican senators, say he didn't use it, at least not that particular word. But aside from that, we know the president can be very, shall we say, blunt, if not just outright crude, and so he may have used a word similar to that, whatever he used. The point is that he's saying, look, why are you taking certain people not based on merit kind of a thing? And some Democrats were getting some pressure from their constituents saying, why are you giving up on certain issues? Why are you dealing with this president? The whole kind of resist movement sort of a thing. They didn't want to see Trump get a win on anything, immigration or otherwise. And so there was some pressure on them to find perhaps a way out. So there's some suggestion that maybe this was a way for the Democrats to do so, that this kind of blew up. So, there are a couple of things going on here and there, and all of them seem to point to making it much more difficult to get any kind of a deal done, especially by this Friday. But hopefully things can calm down and maybe find a way to to sort of work out those details to get enough people on board, because Republicans are going to need some Democratic support, particularly in the Senate, to get anything through.
House Speaker Paul Ryan called President Trump's comments, quote, very unfortunate and unhelpful. And other Republican lawmakers spoke out against the president's comments as well. What should we make of President Trump's remarks and the broad accusations of racism against him?
Well, as far as the first part, and again, just assuming that he did make them, or he said something at least, if not the specific thing that Senator Durbin from Illinois was suggesting that he said, but assuming that Trump said something, it's hardly a surprise that this is something that has been his, I don't want to say trademark, but something that's been fairly consistent, where occasionally Trump says something that shocks people to a certain extent, because you don't usually expect your elected officials or candidates running for president at the time to say those sorts of things, because they're either very blunt or they're crude to a certain extent. And certainly if you're in a private meeting, it's certainly not the first time that we've seen politicians in private say things that are, shall we say, not particularly diplomatic or not meant for public consumption. And that's one of the reasons why Trump tweeted out saying, you know, a lack of trust, that he thought that he was in a meeting that, you know, he could say specifically what was on his mind in the way that he might ordinarily say so rather than what he might say in public. And again, we know that other politicians have, you know, basically a potty mouth in private sometimes, but manage to control themselves in public. Well, with Trump, he was maybe thought he was in a meeting, so he's saying sorts of things. And the fact that some countries, whether it's Haiti or some African nations or what have you, that some countries are in very difficult straits is certainly true, and it's certainly something that members of both parties have said on occasion. Just in this situation, Trump said it in a very crude way that shocked people and, you know, potentially gave, again, Democrats a way out of dealing, having to deal with or look like they were the ones pulling out of any kind of immigration deal. And then that slides into the second part of your question, which is that, you know, many people have believed that President Trump is a racist. They've, you know, looked to his comments that he said, he's even as a candidate, criticism of the judge of Mexican heritage. He said, oh, he's from Mexico, so, you know, he's going to decide against me. And, you know, he said some other things, the whole immigration ban. But people find these things as a way to suggest that Trump is a racist. Trump, of course, says he's not, and, you know, has evidence to suggest otherwise in his past, but at least in terms of current actions and statements, there's some people that basically believe him to be a racist. And so the fact that he's saying that certain people from certain countries are these, you know, very bad countries, and again, the vulgar word or the crude word, that doesn't necessarily suggest that the people coming from those countries are bad, but it's an easy leap if you're looking to criticize the president.
Tim Hagel is with us, an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa, and we're unpacking the latest political developments. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on immigration reform and where DACA stands right now? What do you think about the president's use of an expletive in reference to Haiti, El Salvador, and African nations? Do you think it's possible that the government could shut down by the end of the week? 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's take a moment and talk about the border wall. Tim Hagel, where do the immigration talks leave us with the border wall with Mexico? The Trump administration has proposed spending $18 billion over 10 years to significantly extend the border wall with Mexico. How is that fitting into the conversation about DACA?
Well, it's one of the things where it's kind of a sticking point for Democrats that they don't, especially don't like the talk of a wall. Now, in the last few days, particularly since those talks kind of blew up because of you know, Trump's alleged comments, that people have pointed out, Republicans particularly have pointed out, that Democrats in the past have voted for border security, or they've suggest that they are in favor of border security. So now we get into the semantics of, well, what's the difference between doing a wall versus border security, and, you know, what are the costs involved and so forth. And even Trump now has said, well, the wall is not going to be this, you know, 2,000 or how many ever miles it is wall during the whole time, because you don't need that. But there are certain natural features where you wouldn't need a wall and other places where a fence or something else would be appropriate. But the fact that Trump still talks about a wall is something that then usually raises the ire of Democrats, that they don't want to see that. They don't like that idea, even to the extent they might be encouraged or induced to vote for higher border security of one sort or another. But then you even get some Republicans that are concerned about this because they don't believe that Mexico is going to pay for whatever it is that's going to happen, a wall or increased border security. And so they're concerned about the debt and how that will affect it. So you get a variety of little issues going on here, which is not surprising. This often happens with big legislation, that you have conflicting interests even within one's own party to try to get something through. And that's what's going on with specifically any kind of wall or border security issue right now.
University of Iowa political science professor Tim Hagel is with us. You too can join in the conversation. The latest developments in politics, 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a check of the news. South Africa is among a growing number of countries taking action against President Trump's remarks last week that Haiti, El Salvador, and African nations are S-hole countries whose citizens are not desirable for U.S. immigration. South Africa's government called for a meeting yesterday with the acting U.S. ambassador in Pretoria as part of a diplomatic protest of Trump's comments. One of the political developments we're discussing this hour with University of Iowa political science professor Tim Hagel. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about deep political divides on immigration? Are you fearful of a federal government shutdown? What do you make of Hawaii's accidental missile warning? 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Todd now, who joins us from Green Bay. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good morning. You know, several different points. One, I think, you know, it's been denied to the president that he's what everyone is attributing to him, as well as to.
Oh, Todd, you're breaking up. I'm so sorry, but I think you were trying to make a point that this narrative about the comment and what the president said is a distraction from the positive meeting he had with Democrats. Is that right? And Todd, I think, is now fully out of range. Tim Hagel, it sounds as if there was some progress trying to be made last week with Democrats on immigration.
Yeah, and part of that meeting that you were referencing there was where Trump had on camera, which is unusual, something like 55-minute meeting, and then it extended beyond that after the cameras weren't there. And Trump looked very good. Now, part of the reason that he held that meeting was because he had basically spent the weekend prior being savaged for being incompetent or insane or, you know, whatever it happens to be because of that book, Fire and Fury. So he basically brings these people together, and it was an interesting thing because even though the cameras were there initially and people are a little more cautious usually when the cameras are present, but people did loosen up and they started talking, and you got a dialogue going, which was nice in this particular era of severe partisanship. And so they seemed to be making a certain amount of progress. And so Trump got some kudos for that. But then, of course, once the revelation of whatever it was that he said in the meeting occurred, then all that went away. And so that was one of the things that often Republicans complain about, is that Trump basically steps on his own successes by doing these sorts of things or saying these sorts of things. And so that's where then, to the extent that you know, people were making progress, it kind of fell away, because now for any Democrats to now negotiate with Trump, he's negotiating with what many of their constituents see as, oh, he's racist, he said these terrible things, how can you negotiate with him with somebody like that? And that makes any kind of deal that much more difficult.
the deal on immigration, or a deal, if it is in the works at this point, is rolled into another whole issue, which is the pending government shutdown. Do you think the government will manage to reach a funding deal by the end of the week if lawmakers don't reach any compromises on immigration?
I think the short answer is yes, not to say that it will be pleasant or pretty necessarily. As I had mentioned before, the linking the some sort of deal on immigration, and particularly the DACA Dreamers situation with the government funding, isn't necessarily required. Those two things don't have to go together. It just sometimes it seems that if you can link a couple of issues together, that maybe you can bring people together in a certain way or get things done by doing that. It's not necessary, however, to whatever extent the immigration deal has fallen through and isn't going anywhere at this point, or at least not within the next couple of days, we do have to do something about government funding. And what will likely happen, as many observers have suggested, is that we'll probably have another continuing resolution, which simply means that instead of any kind of long-term budget, it's a short-term. Sometimes it's a little bit longer, like I think I've seen them as much as, you know, 90 days or so, a couple of months. But it's often a month, a couple of weeks, something of that nature, and that's probably what we're going to see happen, potentially even late on Friday, that they'll find some way to get the votes to keep the government going.
Haven't we been on continuing resolutions since, like, October? How long can these go on?
Forever, unfortunately, and we've seen them on a regular basis. And in fact, I was thinking that at the time I was working in the Justice Department in 2006 or after the 2006 elections, and at that point, Republicans, who are now a lame duck control of Congress, basically passed a continuing resolution rather than dealing with the budget situation and said, all right, look, Democrats are going to take over. We'll let them deal with it. Then Democrats basically weren't able to get budgets through either for a while. And so we started to see that kind of fairly regular basis where whoever happens to be in control isn't able to put together a long-term budget on many occasions. And especially, again, in the era of very severe partisanship, it's that much harder to get votes from the other party to support your particular position. And this is a particular concern in the Senate where you usually have to have 60 votes, not always, but depending on the particulars, they usually have to have 60 votes to get anything done. And we haven't seen either party have a 60-vote majority for some time now.
What would, in broad strokes, what would a government shutdown look like? What would it entail?
Well, we've seen them before, and what it usually means is that what would be considered non-essential services are stopped, that certain offices would close, certain people would be furloughed, although they often will get paid retroactively once it comes in, which, of course, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, that doesn't help a whole lot to get the money later if you need the rent payment now. What we've seen has been sometimes ridiculous. You may recall when the government shut down before that they tried to wall off certain memorials that are outdoor memorials, like World War II Memorial on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., that they tried to barricade it off, even though it's an outdoor sort of thing and people can usually just walk through it any time of the day. And so with this thing, I was sort of thinking about this, what would they do in this situation, because you've actually got a Republican president and Republican majorities in Congress, if for some reason you had a government shutdown, that you wouldn't have the administration look to find the most painful way or the most visible way of showing that the government is shut down. That you'll often see, as I said, they'll shut down the museums on the Smithsonian museums on the National Mall in D.C. And that's, you know, you get poignant pictures of kids looking in locked doors because they can't get in the museum kind of a thing. You want to make it hurt to make people to see that if you want to blame the other party for it. So my guess is that if it did shut down, you wouldn't see those kinds of visible things, but you would have certain problems where, again, certain offices would shut down, things like national parks. You know, maybe the people that are running it, that they would have to just close the park on those days. I don't know how many people are going to at least northern parks at this point because it's wintertime, but southern ones and so forth and other offices, they just wouldn't have people staffing it, and so certain things would not get done. But other essential services would still continue, defense in particular.
Yeah, what about the military? Would this touch the military and defense?
You know, it certainly would to some extent. Again, our essential services, it would not affect the military that they would continue on, but there would probably be things like canteens or civilian employees might be, if their job was not considered essential, clerks of one sort or another, they might be furloughed for however long the shutdown lasts. But usually there's enough of a backlash where it forces members of Congress to get their act together fairly quickly and get the people, get some sort of continuing resolution passed. But I would say my best guess is that we will see something by Friday at least to keep the government going at least for a few more weeks while members of Congress continue to work out some sort of a longer-term budget.
Let's pivot to what happened in Hawaii over the weekend. Residents and tourists were shaken Saturday when a push notification alerted everyone to an impending missile threat, causing an immediate panic until officials confirmed 38 minutes later that it was a false alarm. Here's Hawaii's Governor David Ige's response to the mistake.
It's unfortunate and regrettable. We will be looking at how we can improve the procedures so it doesn't happen again.
So what do you make of what just occurred there in Hawaii?
Well, it's certainly, I guess I would echo the governor saying it's an unfortunate mistake. And it is a little surprising that you didn't have some additional fail-safe kind of situation where that type of simple mistake couldn't occur. Or if it did occur, that you had a way to quickly reverse course. As you said, it was 38 minutes or so before they could basically say, no, this is a test, or this is a mistake, there's not a missile coming, and so forth. And even though the message that was sent out only mentioned a missile, didn't necessarily nuclear, but of course you think the worst case scenario in that type of situation that it would be, and that's why there was a lot of concern. And of course, maybe something for us here in the Midwest, that we don't see it quite that way. We, aren't living as close to the threat the way that Hawaii is and has been for some time. And so for their residents, clearly this is something that was of great concern. But it still was a state matter. And, we're just talking about all the concerns that people had about President Trump. And a lot of people quickly jumped to trying to blame Trump for this. But he really had, and the federal government really had nothing to do with it, in that it's a state situation that occurred. And what was nice was that you heard the governor there of Hawaii, but also the administrator that was in charge of the particular department that sent that out. They stood up right away and said, look, this was on us. This is our mistake. We put procedures in place fairly quickly to try to make sure this doesn't happen again. And both the state and the federal government are going to take a look at this and see if there is something that can be done to make sure this doesn't happen. My one concern about this, though, is that by putting in additional fail-safes, will it take more time to get a message out if there were a real missile launch to warn the citizens, that especially in Hawaii, they don't have a whole lot of time. It's only something like 20 minutes. I heard some people say 30, but sort of the low end was 20 minutes between launch and contact. And about half of that time is all the warning that people would get. And if you put additional procedures in place to make sure that whatever the message goes out, is certain it's a message, that's good, because you don't want additional mistakes. But you also don't want to cut down the amount of warning time that people would have in the case of the true launch.
The Federal Communications Commission said on Sunday that its initial investigation of the mistaken alert had concluded that Hawaii did not have reasonable safeguards or process controls in place in its emergency notification process. We're talking right now with Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa about the false alarm about an incoming ballistic missile that sent Hawaii into panic over the weekend and other political developments that we have seen over the week. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What political developments are you watching this week? What questions do you have about the latest in politics? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Dwayne now, who joins us from Hayward. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi. Even though crying wolf is never a good thing because it gives people a false sense of what's really going on, I wonder how many people in Hawaii actually took appropriate actions to save themselves. they need to think, if this was real, did I do the right thing? Did I seek cover, or did I stand around going, nothing's going to happen?
Dwayne, thanks so much. I know we saw TV images of people running for their lives. We saw another image of a child being lured into a manhole. Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, we saw those images, and it's hard to say to what extent they were actually widespread. I'd also seen some reports from apparently one person who was on vacation, and I don't know if this is true or if it was just somebody that, you know, was tweeting out this as a joke, but it's basically saying that, well, you know, the line at the buffet, everybody took off, so I got in line again, that the line was a lot shorter, and, you know, other people probably did go on with their lives. On a more serious note, though, I saw that one person was suggesting that they don't have a lot of shelters, particularly if it was a nuclear warhead on the missile, if it had been launched, that they don't have basements in Hawaii, that they don't have a lot of shelters built. So that may be a conversation that people are going to have going forward, saying, well, look, maybe we do need to take this a little more seriously. Yes, this was a mistake this time, but the possibility is real, or at least more real than it's been since the Cold War.
Do you think our nation's reaction to this incident has been colored by the state of international politics right at this moment?
I think it has, particularly in Hawaii, again, because they are so close to North Korea and certainly within range, although a good chunk of the continental United States is within range now, according to various reports. It's hard to say whether North Korea can actually deliver a missile with accuracy that far, but there's that potential. And yes, certainly the tensions are rising to the extent that North Korea is getting closer and closer to developing a deliverable nuclear weapon.
Turning now to news about North Korea, President Trump told the Wall Street Journal, quote, I probably have a very good relationship with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. On Sunday, the president claimed that the newspaper deliberately misquoted him and that what he really said was, I'd probably have a good relationship with Kim Jong-un. In other words, he would have a good relationship with the North Korean leader if he wanted one. What should we make of the current situation with North Korea and where the U.S. fits in to the Koreas?
That's a tough question. Like many of the ones dealing with international relations with certain countries that seem to be unwilling to kind of join the community of nations in a way that North Korea has chosen not to. As far as the I sort of a thing, that I saw somebody indicate that he had filtered out the background noise and slowed it down and sort of looked at it. He thought that the president said I. That's one of those very fast things. You kind of hear what you want, especially after you've seen it once. That part, you know, I'm not real worried about that. But in terms of the overall relationship, some people are very concerned that Trump has taken a stronger position, if you want to say more aggressive, trying to deal with it. Well, it may be simply because what's worked in the past hasn't, or what we've done in the past hasn't worked. Maybe you do need something that's a little more a stronger stance of one sort or another. And to a certain extent, the fact that North Korea and South Korea are talking over participation of North Korea in the upcoming Winter Olympics, maybe that's actually a good sign that whatever is going on is working. It's one of these things that we just don't know. We're going to have to wait and see how it all turns out.
We learned yesterday that North Korea will send a 140-member musical group to South Korea during the Winter Olympics. We also learned that the two Koreas agreed in principle to field a joint women's ice hockey team and have communicated that to the International Olympic Committee. You're listening to the latest political developments, and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, an associate professor of political science there, is with us. He's our guide to national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you looking for from the two Koreas as we are now less than a month away from the start of the Winter Olympics? Where should the U.S. stand with North Korea? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back after a check of the latest news. Stay with us. News news coming out this morning that former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon will be on Capitol Hill today, expected to testify behind closed doors to the House Intelligence Committee as part of its investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. And we know that former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski expects to voluntarily testify behind closed doors before Congress this week as part of that Russia probe. Lewandowski firmly denies any wrongdoing. He didn't specify the committee he'll appear before, but sources have told CNN that he's expected to testify before the House Intelligence Committee. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the Russia probe and tensions between North and South Korea and where the U.S. fits in. As part of our discussion points this hour with Tim Hagel, he's an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He stays with us as our guide to national politics. You can join in on these conversations, the Russia probe, North and South Korea, 800-642-1234. What are you looking for from the two Koreas now that we're less than a month away from the start of the Winter Olympics? Where do you see the Russia probe going next? 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Tim, the Russia investigation, meanwhile, continues to move on. The headlines this week that the House Intelligence Committee is having some interviews today with former White House strategist Steve Bannon. What do you make of that?
Well, it's interesting. It's certainly somebody who may have some information in terms of what sorts of things the campaign did. Now, how much Steve Bannon was part of it and how long he was part of it was maybe minimized more than Manafort, a former campaign manager for Trump's campaign, but certainly as a high-level advisor and so forth for Trump, that he should have information if there's any to be had relevant to any kind of improper, right? I hate to use the word collusion because that's what we're sort of looking to see, and that's not necessarily a crime in and of itself, but looking to see if there's anything inappropriate going on in terms of contacts with Russia or strategy and so forth. Of course, the other thing that I was thinking is, or you were talking about the report, is that maybe at this point, before Steve Bannon goes in to testify, that Trump is regretting calling him Sloppy Steve a number of times and kind of getting on his case, because, again, it may encourage Bannon to be maybe a little more forthcoming or a little more direct in some of his testimony if he's not happy with the way he's been treated by Trump recently.
Will President Trump be called before Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation? What is the status of that?
Well, we heard some rumors that perhaps there was some negotiating going on in terms of either Trump appearing before the committee in some way. Mueller probably would be the person to do it, as the, you know, because President Trump is such a high-level person that it would expect that it was the head of the investigation would lead it, although there would certainly be other members of Mueller's team there as well. It could be an in-person kind of a thing, not unlike what we saw with Clinton back in the day with the Lewinsky matters, or it could be that it's written sorts of things. And I'm sure that Trump's lawyers would prefer the written approach, because then they have more control over what's being said. As we talked earlier in the show, that Trump has this way of speaking and being somewhat loose in terms of what he says, and that's the kind of a thing that can get you in trouble if you are in sort of on the record and basically have a potential for perjury if you say something incorrect or kind of go off script from what you and your lawyers have said. Okay, this is how we address these sorts of issues. And so the attorneys for Trump would undoubtedly, and the administration would undoubtedly, prefer some sort of a written deposition type situation rather than an in-person interview. But either way, Mueller probably will do it. If he doesn't, even if, let's put it this way, if Mueller doesn't really think that it's necessary, he's probably still going to need to do it anyway, simply because if he doesn't, he's going to get criticized by Democrats, like, oh, why didn't you talk to the person who's, you know, the one that we think is the guilty party from the Democrats' point of view. But, of course, if Mueller does find something to suggest that maybe there were some inappropriate contacts or communications that went on, then he's going to have to find some way to, if not interview Trump, at least get him on record of saying what happened.
Well, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team is also investigating whether the president tried to obstruct justice in the Russia probe. Is there that element as well as they approach an interview or not?
Well, there is, to the extent that one of the things that's always a potential problem if you're the object of the investigation is that the investigation isn't usually limited to whatever it was the original point of appointing either a special counsel, an independent counsel, or whatever the title happens to be at that particular time. And that's what we saw previously, where Ken Starr's investigation of the Clinton administration had to do with the Whitewater stuff, land deals in Arkansas, and ended up going in the direction of, oh, well, now we've got the Lewinsky thing, and, you know, President Clinton's on the record, and he's basically lying, and then, you know, all of this happens. And so we had to deal with all that stuff going on. Well, that was a good example, and we saw that in the Bush administration, where the special counsel or independent counsel, I forget what it was called at that time, basically was investigating one thing and ended up charging a couple people, Scooter Libby in particular, for something kind of related but really off the track. And so that's the problem that you have, is that these things tend to go on. The investigations tend to take on a life of their own and get into a variety of other things. Now, in particular, as far as the obstruction of justice charge goes, at least as far as what we know right now in terms of particularly the firing of Comey, that just doesn't strike me as an obstruction kind of a thing, because the president has that particular power where he can, choose to fire people. Now, even if you fire the head of the FBI, that it's not going to stop the investigation, because you've got a whole organization, you've got a whole team that's there, and the next person is just going to pick it up and go forward. So that's why it doesn't make a lot of sense to suggest that that's an obstruction of justice. It may have been that, you know, whatever it is that the Trump administration says was reason for it, they didn't like it, they didn't think he was doing a good job. And so I think that would be a very hard one to at least given what we know right now, a hard one to show. But if there was something else going on, and that's one of the things that the Mueller investigation is going to look into, is whether there's something else that would suggest more specifically the intent to actually obstruct justice beyond the powers of the president to hire and fire particular government officials.
Do you think Robert Mueller will be able to stay on the job as special counsel? Because we have also heard rumblings that President Trump may get rid of him.
Yeah, I don't put much stake in a lot of those rumblings. It may have been the kind of a thing where people are floating this as an idea so that other people get upset about it. Now, I have to, a little caveat when I say this, but it would be a huge mistake politically for Trump to fire Mueller at this point, because of everything that's gone on, things we just mentioned in terms of firing Comey and, you know, just the general stuff that's going on. And even though Trump may not like what Mueller's investigating and what's happened, that, again, it would just be a huge political mistake. Now, the caveat there is that we've seen Trump make these apparent huge political mistakes in the past. So I suppose it's possible under certain circumstances, but it would create even more of a firestorm that we're seeing right now, because there are so many people that do not like Trump for a variety of reasons. And I'm thinking in particular members of Congress, Democrats in particular, but some Republicans as well. And so were he to do something like this, it just adds fuel to that fire. It would make it even that much more difficult for the administration and Republicans in Congress to get anything done. And so I'm sure that everybody up and down the line is advising the president to not fire Mueller, no matter how irritated he might get with Mueller.
With that said, what challenges do you see as this investigation moves forward for the White House and the GOP?
Well, for the White House, it certainly makes it more difficult for them to get their agenda through, in part because to get anything through, they have to work with members of Congress. And that's something that I think Trump is finally figuring out. He didn't have a good handle on that, I think, when he first came into office, and we sort of saw the result of that with the failure of a repeal of the Affordable Care Act. But with the passage of the Tax Reform Act, that now he seems to be understanding how he's got to work with Congress. I mean, he hasn't learned everything to that extent, because we're still seeing issues as far as the immigration stuff. But, you know, it's sort of a learning curve as you become president, particularly somebody who isn't familiar with how government works in that sense, sort of on the inside kind of a thing, as opposed to an outside view of it.
So do you think
of Go ahead.
Do you think that the Russia investigation, is it having any effect on what the GOP is trying to do in passing legislation and trying to achieve campaign promises?
In terms of the investigation itself, probably not that much. And that's sort of where I was going to go with this, is that for Republicans, it's difficult because at this point, now that we're into the new year, you've got to start looking forward to the midterm elections. And there's a concern, a growing concern, that the Republicans may lose control of one or both houses in Congress. I'm not sure that's going to happen. I don't really see that there's a wave building at this point. But usually the majority party, the party in the White House, will lose some seats in the midterm elections. And because the majority for the Republicans in the Senate is, you know, so razor thin, that it would be not surprising for Democrats to take control, even though they're defending a lot more seats than Democrats are. But to the extent that Republican candidates, either incumbents or otherwise, are asked about what's going to happen or what's happening or what's going on with the Russian stuff, that is a problem for them, because they would like to run on the issues in their state or their district, and yet they're getting, you know, having to deal with these sort of national things. I think a bigger problem for a lot of Republican candidates, though, is less the Russian collusion thing at this point than the other distractions, like the vulgar comments that we were talking about in the earlier in the show. But having said that, if the Mueller investigation produces some more indictments, particularly ones that are more closely tied to the campaign itself, and I say that because like the Manafort indictment had more to do with his financial dealings prior to the campaign, or other indictments were dealing with lying, like with Flynn, with lying to the FBI. Well, that's not really the collusion thing that everybody was looking for. So if there's something more directly tied to campaign, that's when it's going to hurt Republican candidates for Congress.
Tim, thank you as always.
You're very welcome.
Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa and a faculty advisor to the University of Iowa College Republicans. This hour of the morning show was produced by Colleen Leahy and Brianne Shasso. Nyasia Ellison is also producing. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. Dean Kinetter provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.